Hosts Takes on the World, a program on international affairs. This program was first heard on January 8, 2014, on KZYX Radio in Mendocino County, California. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. If you have a pen handy, here's info for you to write down. On tucradio.org, you will also find the link to Senate Bill 1881 and the uscongress.gov. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for more information. A limited number of audio CDs are available online at tucradio.org or by phone at 707-463-2654. TUC Radio's secure website is tucradio.org and the email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.
Hi, Paul Fisher from WBAI then and WBAI now. Tired of pesky programs interrupting our fascinating fundraising drives? No problem. Don't touch that dial. We can sell you conspiracies and miracle cures till the sun goes supernova. Or you can help WBAI again become a station known for programs, not just products. How? Thought you'd never ask. Become a BAI buddy. That's a minimum $10 a month donation for each of the next 12 months. Help end the heartbreak of psoriasis cures and other lotions, potions, and nostrums sold on the radio by sending us money to make radio. Go to WBAI.org, our website, and become a BAI buddy. Well, I don't know.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. Guess what? It's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Bump, dilly, bump, for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. Bump, dilly, bow.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Mike.
Hi there.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And from somewhere else, Bernie S.
Buried in the snow in Philadelphia. Greetings tonight.
Greetings, greetings. You really cut it to the last second there, didn't you? Just called in this very moment. Yeah, we were pretty frantic here. We didn't have our theme. Somehow lost our off-the-hook tone. No need to panic. We'll find it by next week. everything will be back to normal. Hey, we have a lot of exciting announcements, hope-related announcements. A lot has gone on in the last week. For one thing, the call for participation has gone out, and we're already being swamped with people writing into us and asking what they can do. Basically, we have a conference coming up in
July.
In July. What we're doing then is having having a lot of people speaking as they do every time we have a Hope conference every 2 years. Bernie, any thoughts from you on this?
Well, I think you kind of understated it, Emmanuel. We typically have about 100 people speaking at Hope and dozens of people presenting workshops, and there's so much more going on there. Just to say there's a few people speaking is you're just scratching the surface.
Mm-hmm. But it's over 100 different presentations given at every conference, and probably more this time, because every time we do this, we manage to squeeze in a bit more. We find more rooms we can use, and there seems to be more interest. In fact, I can say for sure there's more interest this time. We have more people registering for the conference than ever before at this rate. We also have people normally that we would be chasing down to give talks are coming to us, pleading, begging. Well, maybe not pleading and begging, but basically wanting to be involved because this is important. These are important times. It's an extremely relevant period of history with all that's been going on in the last few years. And Hackers on Planet Earth is something that has always been at the forefront of this, and I think it's going to be particularly relevant this year. It takes place July 18, 19, and 20 at the Hotel Pennsylvania, Midtown Manhattan. If you go to www.hope.net, you'll see our brand new website, too, with all kinds of cool features and bits of information. You'll see the call for speakers there, how you can participate, the call for workshops. Bernie, you want to tell us something about workshops? What's that all about?
We Hope number 9, which was 2 years ago, was really the first year we really went out all out with workshops, and we had dozens of workshops, 24 workshops last time. Some of them were really good sort of breakout sessions to talks, where, you know, you heard a really good talk, but the person talked about building some interesting thing or hacking some interesting program, and then you can get together with them in a smaller, more intimate setting and do sort of a hands-on interactive workshop. You can build the thing that they were talking about or work on some collaborative project that they were talking about at the talk earlier that day. So it's just a really nice segue, no pun intended, because we have segues at Hope as well to ride around. But it really sort of makes a full circle from just hearing about it to being a hands-on participatory event. And that's what Hope's all about, is getting involved, getting your hands dirty, working on stuff. Not necessarily dirty, but just hands-on, doing stuff.
You can get dirty. I mean, we have wash basins that you can rinse yourself off if you do get dirty. It's a hacker conference. Anything can happen.
Right. And this being the 20th anniversary of the first Hope back in 1994, this is going to be, and the 10th actual Hope conference, since we do it every couple of years.
I still don't understand. I still understand how that works out mathematically, because every 2 years we have the conference. And we've been doing this for 20 years now, but the first couple, we only had 3 years spaced apart. So mathematically, I don't know how it can be both the 20th anniversary of Hope and the 10th Hope.
It doesn't make sense. But
it makes no sense.
I don't know how.
And not only that, it's the 30th anniversary of 2600 Magazine as well.
How did you pull that off?
I didn't. It's just all...
I mean, the planets are
It's in the prophecies. I know, but I don't understand. I tried to avoid it.
I'll sit down with some paper later, and we'll draw lines and squares and...
What kind of paper?
Out.
What kind of paper did you bring? Oh, you mean the
paper
two.
To do some math?
Yeah. Okay, got
yeah,
it.
I don't. I think it requires some graphical demonstrations we can't do on the radio, but we'll work it out.
All right. Well, now speaking of segues, Bernie. Segues. I don't know if that does that qualify. That's not a workshop. That's an activity.
No, that's just one of the fun attractions. There's not just talks and workshops and panels.
Mm-hmm.
There are all kinds of activities, and there's attractions that I would call the segues an attraction. You can ride around on these multi-$1,000, really hacker-friendly devices that have all kinds of gyroscopes and computers in them, and they kind of read your mind as you ride these things around.
They do. And what you say about attractions is true, because we always are experimenting with different attractions. The Segways obviously being one of the attractions that has worked. The giraffe didn't work out. We only did that once, and that turned out to be a big mess and not very popular. But, you know, it just shows that we are willing to try new and different things. But on the subject of the Segway, what year did we start doing that? Because what's weird about the Segway is that it's still this new thing that no one has really tried before in the mainstream. So as long as it remains unattainable to most people, it's a cool thing for us to have.
I believe it was the fifth hope. It was the same hope that Steve Wozniak came. And I remember that because the guy I got to bring a Segway, just one Segway, was a friend of Steve Wozniak, who is himself a big Segway fan. So it just all worked out really well. And then that worked out so well that we started bringing in more Segways at each additional hope.
Now, on that subject of weird things that few people have, there has been some talk of Google Glass at Hope. Now, obviously, somebody, some wise guy is going to be wearing Google Glass throughout. But what I was thinking, tell me if you think this is a good idea, and literally, we're discussing this live on the radio. We're open to all kinds of input. If on the opposite side, where we have the Segways, people lining up for the Segways, we have people on the other side of the huge room lining up to play with Google Glass. What do you think about that?
So, I'll tell you
why. I was asking Bernie, but I'm sure you're going to say something totally tear it down.
I'll tell you why I'm not interested, because I am much more interested in seeing the things that are not like the products of large corporations like the Segway Corporation and Google Corporation. I'm much more interested to see the creativity that the hacker community can bring and always does bring to this event.
So you will not be on that line. So there you go, folks. There's one less person to have to shove out of the way. But I'm just thinking, you know, I've never used one of these things. In fact, a couple of people have asked, would you like to be put on the invite list for Google Glass? And I say, well, okay, yeah, sure, but I'm you know, it's an invitation to spend $1,500. I probably won't do it. And then they don't put me on because there's this whole like marketing thing going on. It's kind of like a pyramid scheme of some sort where people, I'm going to get letters now. Every time I criticize Google, I get letters. Basically, they don't put you on the list of people that are being invited to spend $1,500 unless you basically commit to saying that you're going to take it seriously and do this and live by all the terms.
Oh, at Gmail. Remember how they did that?
They did that with Gmail. It's called creating value in something that that's really getting people to spend money. But what I'm thinking is that this is something that a lot of people won't have access to. I don't have access to. I'm not going to be spending money on that kind of thing. And I also have heard from people that have asked me not to say this publicly, but I don't care because I don't see why I shouldn't, that it's really clumsy and sloppy and in beta mode, and they would not recommend it. So there. Yeah, I betrayed confidence in saying that. It's a cool thing. I'm not saying it's not cool to have these devices and these toys and to play around with them, but that's what we want to do at the conference, is give people the opportunity to play around and experiment and see just what everybody is talking about. I should point out though that if we do this, those two lines are going to be kept very, very separate. The, the Segway riders and the Google Glass users, do not mix the two. I don't think that would be a good idea at all. Bernie, what do you think of the idea of just having people line up to test out Google Glass, give that a test drive?
Well, I'm kind of with Mike on this. I would much rather see an open-source hardware software version of that. It probably improves on it and makes it cooler and more versatile.
Well, is there one?
There are people working on such things, and by the time Hope rolls around in July, even though it doesn't seem like it's that far away, I think there will be comparable things out there from other folks, and I think we should look at that.
I'd be open to that too if such a thing existed, but I'd be open to doing it whatever does exist at that time, for sure. So anyway, that's,
by the way, Google Glass can get you arrested too, by the way.
Yeah, and we have a story about that. This happened at a movie theater in Ohio. There was a Google Glass user who they say he ran into an unexpected consequence of wearing a camera on his face at all times, which is basically what Google Glass is. Now, movie theaters can suspect you of piracy if you do that. This Google Glass user, who has not yet given his name, contacted the tech blog known as The Gadgeteer. He and his wife had bought tickets to see Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit at a mall theater on January the 18th. He wore his Google Glass set with prescription lenses. And about an hour into the film, they were approached by someone claiming to be a federal agent. And as the user phrased it, this is what was said. The guy came near my seat, shoved a badge. It had some sort of a shield on it because, well, they all do. He yanked the Google Glass off my face, which is a violation of Google terms, by the way, just so people know that, and said, follow me outside immediately. It was very embarrassing. And outside of the theater, there were about 5 to 10 cops, as well as mall cops. He went on to say that the agent told him he had been caught illegally taping the movie, then ushered him and his wife into separate rooms in the mall's administrative area. And although the ensuing interview was described as voluntary, it was suggested that not cooperating could result in bad things happening. Now, federal agents questioned the man about whom he reported to, how much money he made, and other things related to the alleged piracy. And when they finally brought in a laptop and cable to check the contents of the man's Google Glass and his phone, they found nothing incriminating and turned him loose. Here's what baffles me. How in God's name did they find federal agents to swoop down on this theater inside of an hour after somebody is seen going to a movie with Google Glass? They had ICE representatives, Homeland Security, FBI supposedly, and this is something, it's like an episode of South Park. They basically swooped in because this is the biggest crime being committed within 100 miles. Does this seem fishy to you, Rob?
I'm just relieved to hear that the federal government has solved every other problem on its plate that's more important than some guy in a movie theater in a mall in Google Glass.
I guess we have to assume they did, because, wow, they sure were ready for this. And God forbid something else was happening anywhere in that mall or anywhere else, for that matter.
And actually, I think the government did him a service, because otherwise he might have had to sit through that movie.
Well, okay, yeah, I was going to say some things about that, but the less said, the better. Bernie, what are your thoughts on this?
The MPAA has tentacles into all aspects of our law enforcement security apparatus, as we well know. So I think the movie theater probably just called up their MPAA contact, who then made a couple calls, and then the feds swooped down into the movie theater. I think that's what happened.
But one person copying or allegedly copying a movie in a theater, they can do that. I mean, they had. I think close to a dozen different people there from different agencies. And just for one person, what if somebody else was taping something in another part of the town?
Yeah, I think all the agencies wanted to each take credit for being involved in this massively important bust, which was a bust.
Yeah, because they didn't find anything, and they wind up looking pretty red-faced. And, of course, this was verified. This did actually happen. They had to say, I think ICE representative confirmed to NBC News that the man was not detained and would have been free to go should he have chosen to do so. Now, it's interesting. Bernie, you have some experience with law enforcement. If it really was that simple, if you could just leave because you feel like leaving, why don't people just leave then? Is there something they say to make you want to stay?
They say things that are implied threats. So I am not surprised that this guy and his wife did really not feel free to leave. And you can bet if they left, there would have been some other way to detain him. He was basically detained. It sounds like he was detained. He was ordered to, follow them, whatever. It wasn't just said, I'm sure that they did not feel free to leave. That's how it is.
What kind of words would someone say to you to basically cover their ass and say, yeah, he was free to leave at all times, but make the person feel like he has to stay? What kind of tactics?
I think people are generally programmed to do what authority figures say, especially if they happen to be wearing guns and badges and look threatening and menacing and speaking in threatening tones. I'm sure that's what happened there. I'm sure these guys were armed. So it's don't want to go against somebody who's ordering you and has a gun. It's just not wise. I've had federal guns pointed at me, and I know what happens.
So I'm finding it really hard to know who to sympathize with here, because on the one hand, you guys are totally right that this is a total waste in a sense of police power, although I doubt they would have been doing something more useful with the police power instead. But the copyright industry, as we've discussed many times on this program, is insane in its zealous enforcement of its you know, self-invented rights and all this stuff. But on the other hand, I'm a little annoyed at the sort of self-entitlement of the people with Google Glass who think they can just wear a camera and a screen everywhere they go and that everyone else has to think that's okay. There's a case that was reported recently of someone who was wearing Google Glass while driving. There's a law in all relevant states that says you can't have a screen in front of your face while you're driving because that's dangerous. And the person actually somehow managed to get out of that ticket.
They said they had it turned off.
Yeah, there's no way to know.
It's called innocence before guilt, the assumption of innocence.
Yeah, I mean, are you allowed to wear Google Glass in a locker room? Like, where? What are the rules here? And it's, I don't think it's okay that the people who have the $1,500 to spend on this product are the only ones who get to participate in making up the rules.
Well, the thing though is that these are questions we are going to have to increasingly deal with. What happens when Google Glass turns into Google Contact Lens and you can't tell because the person looks like an utter idiot walking around with this thing on that they're recording in the first place? You know, we're moving quickly into that society where people are recording you at all times and you have no idea they're doing it.
I've been recorded with Google Glass. I mean, it was a public talk I gave, so I didn't mind that there was a recording.
Did you snatch them off the person's head?
Well, it was too late by then. Oh. But I, to be clear, I didn't mind that this recording was made, but I certainly didn't know about it in advance.
You see, these are the kind of things that's why I want hands-on to these devices so people can experiment and figure out ways to defeat them or to use them in other manners or whatever. The technology is here. It's not going anyplace. But yeah, we have a lot of questions to answer. And we're seeing this coming up in society more and more.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is that while the technology might improve, people are still the same jerks they always were.
That's certainly true. Speaking of jerks, there's a lot of jerks in Las Vegas. I have nothing against Las Vegas, but I just wanted to segue into a different story. And apparently Las Vegas is moving into the world of bitcoins. Yes, we started last week, and now Las Vegas is following. Starting this week, actually, patrons will be able to use the online currency Bitcoin to pay for rooms, food, and drinks at two downtown casinos, the D Casino. What an imaginative name. And the city's oldest casino, which we all know, of course, is the Golden Gate, will accept bitcoins at hotel front desks beginning Wednesday. The cybercurrency will also be accepted at the D's gift shop and two restaurants. U.S. dollars, however, will remain the only currency accepted on the gambling floor. Unless, of course, they give you those stupid little tokens that you have to get in exchange for U.S. dollars. So that's interesting. It's moving into its the gambling realm now. Where is this going to go? We have no idea. We have no idea how this is going to turn out. It's different. It's weird. It's kind of funny. And that's one of the reasons why we decided we were going to go ahead and take it. We've gotten a bunch of people registering with bitcoins for the Hope Conference. So I think that's kind of cool. And I got to say, there are a lot less fees involved for the merchant. So we wind up getting a better deal than if we use Visa and MasterCard and all those other people. There's only one small fee taken out as opposed to 50 fees that the banks take. So yeah, Bitcoin's on the floor of, well, not on the gambling floor, but in Las Vegas. Something that this kind of bugs me as a proofreader and editor. Half the time you see Bitcoin capitalized, half the time you don't see it capitalized. My understanding, tell me if I'm wrong, is that when you're referring to the concept of it, when you're referring to maybe the company, when you say that you're starting to take Bitcoin, that's when you capitalize. When you're referring to a bunch of them, Bitcoins, you know, I'm going to pay you with Bitcoins, then it's not capitalized. Does that seem like it makes any sense? I see it in this news story here. Mike?
I'm sorry. I don't care.
Well, I didn't ask if you cared. I asked if you had any idea.
I'm just a little confused. So the Las Vegas thing is just like for it's the meme. Like, I heard you like gambling, so now you can gamble while you gamble. Is that what's going on
is
here?
Is that the meme? That's the worst meme I've ever heard.
It's a lot of that. Really?
Because
there's so many bad
ones. I couldn't
ones.
Repeat it now 5 seconds after you said it. That's how confusing it is. Okay. go ahead, Rob.
So I think it might apply like it does when other product names get genericized, like Scotch tape. If you're referring to the Scotch brand that makes Scotch tape, then you would capitalize it. But if it's a store brand Scotch tape,
good.
Then
yes.
Maybe you wouldn't.
I'm going down to the store to buy Scotch tape. Capitalized. I'm going to Scotch tape this together. Not capitalized.
I think
yeah.
That works. I
all
think
right.
That works.
All right. See, we're learning. It's educational radio.
I believe the preferred term is Scottish. And that is capitalized.
All right, fine. Now, here's something rather interesting coming out of the events taking place in Ukraine right now. As people might be following, there's pretty much revolution in the air, all kinds of demonstrations and increasingly violence. And a lot of people today received this text message: "Dear subscriber, you are registered as a participant in a mass disturbance." Yeah, that's the text message thousands of Ukrainian protesters spontaneously received on their cell phones today as a new law prohibiting public demonstrations went into effect. It was the regime's police force sending protesters the perfectly dystopian text message to accompany the newly minted perfectly dystopian legislation. And according to this particular website, whose name was obscured when I printed the text out, unfortunately, this is downright Orwellian. And I don't think you can get more Orwellian than this. What do you think, Bernie?
Well, yeah, because what it implies is that if you're in that protest and you get that message, you know that the government authorities, the guys with the guns and the sticks, and the water cannons and everything and the tear gas, they have your name, your number, your location, and all they need to lock you up or worse. So it would be disturbing. I think that maybe people will learn the next time there or other places where if you go to protest to turn your cell phone off or take the battery out to avoid your location from being logged so that people can pin you on being in a particular place at a particular time.
Well, the phrasing of the message echoed the language in the new law that makes it a crime to participate in a protest that they deem to be violent. And, you know, governments, if you throw a teddy bear at a cop with a riot shield, it's deemed violent. That law took effect actually yesterday. Protesters are concerned the government seems to be using cutting-edge technology from the advertising industry to pinpoint people for political profiling. Now, there are three cell phone companies in Ukraine, Kyivstar, MTS, and Life. They denied they had provided the location data to the government or had sent a text message. That's according to the newspaper Ukrainskaya Pravda. They're suggesting that instead it's the work of a pirate cell phone tower set up in the area. And of course, those messages are having little effect. 3 hours after they were sent, riot police officers pushed back past barricades of burned buses at that site and were met by a crowd of protesters in ski masks and bicycle helmets. Another reason to wear bicycle helmets, carrying sticks and ready to fight. Yeah, it's interesting though to see, these bumbling attempts by authorities to use technology in ways to oppress masses. And the thing that worries me, they can only get better at it.
Yeah, I mean, if they're using your physical location to decide who is a participant in this protest, then, you know, you, Emmanuel, and of course other friends of ours know that it is possible to be at the location of a protest without being part of it. And so how do they decide whose name goes on the list? And I'm just going to take a wild guess here and say everyone's name goes on the list no matter what.
Mm-hmm. As far as technically how it's done, how would you say any of us understand the actual technology behind it?
I mean, there's so many ways to do it. From what we know from the Edward Snowden revelations, from what the NSA is capable of, basically they could get the government the data from the cell providers. The cell providers would probably lie, so their denials mean, you know, nothing at all in this case. They could build a device to see what cell phones are nearby without the cooperation of the cell carriers. They could do, you know, any number of things that probably I can't even think of right now, and there's no way to know which, but it's almost not relevant which, because what they are going to do with the data is the real concern.
Well, I'm curious about this talk of a pirate tower. How would something like that work? The authorities themselves can put up a tower without the help of the cell phone companies, if we believe the cell phone companies? Go ahead, Bernie.
Well, yeah, there's actually a company in the U.S. called Harris Corporation that makes such a device. And it's basically, it's a fake cell phone tower. It's a real cell phone cell site, but it's used in a classic man-in-the-middle attack type method, and it has a lot of other tools. It can turn it on. They can emulate other carriers' cell sites so that all the phones register to the government one, And then they'd have all the phone numbers and IDs of the phones that are within a particular area. And then they can send a message to all of them, log who's there, where they are, that sort of thing. And that's almost certainly what was done. I don't think the government would want to go through the extra trouble of contacting all the carriers. They can just throw a switch on a system like this, which I just read a government quote on one of these things. They're about $250,000 in the U.S.
If somebody were to use this, an entity was to use this particular tower that Harris manufactures, would the calls be made through this tower, or is it completely oblivious to that?
Yes, anybody making calls that have registered to this tower automatically, which they do, the strongest signal is the signal that the cell phone locks onto. Any calls that those phones make will go through that tower and then can be recorded by this system, not just the so-called metadata, the phone number and the phone numbers and all the other information, but the actual audio can be recorded too from these types of systems.
Okay, but what I'm not clear on is who's actually placing the call then? Is it the cell phone company, or are the authorities now a phone company placing a call for you?
The authority is then acting as a man in the middle and then sends the call on to the actual carrier.
Okay, so that's what they're doing. Do they pick the carrier, or do they know what carrier you want to use?
They know which one that your phone typically works with and would send it off to there. And this has been going on for at least 15 years in this country. They have had that technology, this man-in-the-middle type thing. The FBI uses it regularly. You might have seen something in that NSA catalog that Ed Snowden recently leaked to The Guardian and others. So it's this is not new technology. This has been around for a while.
So in addition to that technology, which is a thing that you described that actually does exist, there's other technologies that are passive listening to GSM communications. And some of this is now actually even possible for hobbyists to do, because the encryption in GSM is generally off or in very weakened states. So it is possible to, without doing what you described, to just put a device in a public area and listen for the nearby cellular telephones as they communicate normally with the normal tower. So there's all kinds of possibilities here with varying levels of cooperation from the cell companies and varying levels of, well, I guess it's all pretty evil from the government. But now the question will be if this is just a pure intimidation tactic, which is bad enough, or if they're actually going to follow through and try and arrest some of the people who they know were there through the cell data.
I would like to get one of these towers for the Hope Conference and experiment with it. And, people would opt in, and we could do some real-time monitoring ourselves and see just what these things are capable of. Of course, we have to get one. It's a dream. How do we actually do that? It's impossible. There's just no way. Yeah, I don't really believe it. I think there's always a way if we put our minds to it. So that's one of my wishes.
It's also highly illegal. If you're
Why
not
is it
the
illegal?
Government. Because you're not the government, and the government makes the rules. You know how this works.
Okay, but, inside of that room, we are the government because we're running the conference.
Look, lawyer.
I will get a lawyer.
Yeah, fine.
I will get a lawyer right after the show, and I'll make this happen. Rob, go ahead.
So, yeah, if this is your wish, I think that would be sort of an unreasonable wish to make, unless, of course, you were on a radio show that had an audience of a lot of telecommunication enthusiasts. And, oh, wait.
And I have two more wishes after this. I'm saving those.
Oh, okay. So you save those for a rainy day. But, yeah, if anyone out there has ideas on how we can do this, get in touch with us, projects@hope.net.
That's right. Oh, I neglected to mention, thank you, Rob, earlier, if you want to submit a speaker submission, the address is speakers@hope.net. And it's that simple.
You'll have a much better chance of getting accepted if you go on x.hope.net and read the rules, because then your submission will comply.
True, but perhaps you're driving now and you can't go to a website, but you somehow can send an email. It's good to give out the email addresses as well. And I heard Bernie mentioning workshops@hope.net. Yes, Bernie, that's another address that we have. And what kind of people would email that address besides spammers?
Anybody who's interested in organizing a workshop for Hope, or who, if you are a speaker and would like to have organize a workshop that follows up your talk, or also there's another email address, art.
Or art space, actually.
Art space, I'm sorry, thank you. Art space. And
at hope.net.
Our friend Gus is curating and organizing that.
Yeah, because art and hacking are very tightly connected, and we see all kinds of instances of that throughout the world. And we want it to be more of a a tight connection this time as well. So there are so many talented people around, not only in the hacker community, but in this specific region right here. So that was, there's all kinds of things we can draw upon. Again, www.hope.net is the main website, x.hope.net, specifically for HopeX, which is our 10th conference. And you can just put all those X's into a URL too, xxx.18xsinarow.xxx. That'll get you there as well.
Do we own the domain, you know, 18exsinarow.com?
I don't think so. No. Maybe you could run out and check if that's available. Hey, last week we played something. Well, we said something, actually, and I'm going to play it right now, an exchange that we had with a caller. See if anybody remembers this.
COINTELPRO to the Village Voice, and that's what really, like, blew it up. And Frank Church gets a lot of credit, but mostly Otis Pike was relentless in his coverage. And I found out he's still alive. I'm going to look into how to get a hold of him.
Otis Pike is still alive?
That's what it said on Google. I mean, on there.
Wow, I didn't know that. I just assumed, well, if Otis Pike is listening, my apologies. Yeah, and the caller was right. I was surprised, Otis Pike still being alive. However, unfortunately, since that show has aired, amazingly enough, Otis Pike has died. Can you believe that? It's like fate was listening and saying, oh, wait, I missed one. And 92 years old, and the maverick New York congressman died on January the 20th, just 2 days ago. Kind of scary. Who's listening to this radio show, you know?
I'm not familiar with Otis Pike's work. Could you maybe summarize?
Well, I'm not prepared to summarize his entire career. I just know that he was a congressman. I remember his name because Otis Pike is a really cool name. And I know that he was way back. He was one of the people that was a congressman, I think, back in 1960, according to this article. Okay, you know what? I can tell you something. He served 18 years in Congress. He was a Democrat elected from a Republican-leaning district on Long Island, a Marine Corps veteran who was skeptical of Vietnam War escalation, and a patrician bow-tied lawyer with a wicked sense of humor, which he used to ridicule wasteful spending. Is that enough? I can go on. I have 3 pages.
Okay.
No, is that not? Okay, Bernie, go ahead.
I'm sorry to hear of his passing.
Yeah, it's just kind of creepy that, you know, I thought he was dead. Then it turns out he was still alive, and then he died right after I found out he was still alive. It's kind of weird also, you know, like Ariel Sharon, he kind of died like 8 years ago, and then he came back to life long enough to die for real. Well, he didn't really come back to, you know what I mean. He was in a coma for 8 years, and that was kind of strange because it's like he died twice.
We look forward to your letters.
Yeah, let's back out of this gracefully. Did you have something else? Bernie, go ahead.
Otis Pike was really a whistleblower. I wish there were more congressmen like him, congresspeople like him, because he was a persistent critic of Pentagon, not just overspending, but for overreach, and critic of the CIA and some of the shenanigans it was involved in. And he had this really, really extensive classified report prepared about CIA activities, and it turned out, well, he didn't classify it, but Congress classified it, and he allegedly leaked it to the news media. He never admitted doing that, but it got published by the Village Voice. Hundreds of pages of really interesting information about what our government was doing that it should not have been doing, or at least people should have been aware it was doing. And he'll be missed. I think we have lost his spirit for the most part in the halls of Congress. We could use more like him.
All right. Well, speaking of whistleblowing, I'm not sure if this actually qualifies as whistleblowing, but it's definitely something that's gotten people's attention. Hacking expert David Kennedy, I'm not sure what you have to do to become a hacking expert, but he claims that he has been able to crack healthcare.gov within about 4 minutes and was able to gain access to 70,000 personal records of Obamacare enrollees. Now, of course, he reported this on Fox News and scared people into not registering, I guess, on that website. He said 70,000 was just one of the numbers that I was able to go up to, and I stopped after that. You know, I'm sure it's hundreds of thousands, if not more, and it was done within about a 4-minute time frame. So it's just wide open. You can literally just open up your browser, go to this, and extract all this information without actually having to hack the website itself. Now, I don't know, when I read this, my BS meter kind of went through the roof, because whenever people say that, yeah, it's this easy, you know, I've been to the end of the internet and back and I can do it all, and it's this easy, all you got to do is go to your browser, you don't need any special tools, I want to see the actual evidence. Has anyone actually seen what this guy did to get, within 4 minutes, personal information on 70,000 records? Bernie, did you hear anything?
I just read this article, but of course he was interviewed on Fox News, so it must be true. So, you know, I haven't seen any evidence to it. I mean, I think it's plausible. It could be true, but there's been no evidence presented that I've seen that means it really happened. But even if it did happen, if he doesn't get prosecuted, it's going to show some very selective prosecution, because this sounds almost exactly like somebody in the hacker community named Weave did a couple years ago with AT&T Wireless's website for new iPad users, where the website was so insecure you could just change the URL by one digit or something and grab the email address and name of the user, so, and other information. So if this really happened, and if this guy didn't get prosecuted, I call BS on that.
Okay, so there's enough BS for everybody floating around here. But that said, is it right for someone like this to be prosecuted, do you think?
Well, he could be considered a whistleblower, but I'm just saying that the government would be very capricious and show a double standard by not prosecuting someone who did something like this and prosecuting someone else from the hacker community for doing something almost identical with a corporate website.
But why do you think the government wouldn't prosecute him? This guy is on Fox News attacking healthcare.gov, Obamacare, pretty much directly. You seem to think that he won't be prosecuted. What makes you say that?
Politics, Emmanuel, politics. This guy obviously is trying to make administration look bad, not necessarily a bad thing.
So why wouldn't the administration want to prosecute him? That's what I don't get.
Because it could be labeled as a political prosecution.
So you're saying it's political because they're not prosecuting him because it would be political if they did. It seems like there's no way for this not to be political. You know?
You're right.
All right. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, that's pretty much how politics works, I think.
I guess so. I should know that. All right. Well, yeah, I'd like to know. This guy, David Kennedy, write an article for 2600. Tell us exactly what you did. Because in the hacker community, we like to reveal the information and show people how it's done, not simply make wild claims on dubious news networks and expect that to be enough. I'm used to it. I'm used to people who go around claiming things at conferences and on TV networks that seem really simple, that are designed to make people afraid of hackers. But when you look at it, a lot of it is misleading, not really what they say it is, and sometimes just outright false.
What kind of information does he claim to have taken from this? He says, from this website.
He says it was personal information. I don't know what that means. Personal records, names, addresses, social security numbers, IPs. I don't know.
I mean, I can give you a list of all the social security numbers in the United States, but that's not a huge problem.
Isn't that just a number generator, or do you actually have access to a database? Yeah, I mean, I've been to healthcare.gov. I'm amazed he got it to work and do something. You know, that alone is an accomplishment. Maybe he should just have been satisfied with that. Now, Bernie, you mentioned iPads, which, of course, is related to Apple, and Apple has something to do with this story right now. They have settled a long-standing case with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission over in-app purchases. In-app purchases? What does that word mean?
That means if you're playing a game, and within the game you could spend real world money to get your character in the game something fancier for the game, then that's an in-app purchase. Or if you have an app that you're allowed to try out and use for a while, but then you want to buy the full version, that can also be an in-app purchase. So it's basically an internal purchase made in the game, as if you went out and bought something.
Are you playing a game right now with me? Is this real? I mean, people do this.
I've, for instance, used in-app purchase. Sometimes you have an app and you use it, and there's ads, and you can pay $2 to the developer to make the ads go away.
This is part of your whole Second Life personality?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, according to a letter obtained by Recode.net, the consent decree entered into by the Cupertino, California-based technology giant. Did you know that's where they were based? Indeed. It's important to the story. And the government agency it does not force Apple to do anything we weren't already going to do. That's according to Apple Chief Executive Tim Cook. Always a nice thing to say after you settle a lawsuit. Yeah, we're going to do it anyway. Big waste of time.
Where, Emmanuel, is the government agency in question based?
They don't get to that. Oh. I'm sure somewhere in D.C. The FTC said in the statement that Apple will pay back a minimum $32.5 million to customers affected by the complaint. The agency said the figure was drawn up to consider full consumer redress. Apple will also be required to change billing practices to ensure that express informed consent is received before a purchase is made. The iPhone and iPad maker must make these changes no later than March 31st. The FTC's complaint alleged that Apple did not inform its smartphone and tablet owners that entering their password opened up a 15-minute period in which children could incur unlimited charges with no further adult supervisory intervention. That does sound like a recipe for disaster. So this is all about kids buying things on smartphones.
Yes, indeed. I think we covered a story about this some time ago when it broke. But yeah, the source of grief seems to be that parents would just start up a child's game and hand the child the device to babysit them for a while, like my generation did with television. But when the kid gets handed the tablet and they're playing their game, they have the ability and the chance to spend a bunch of mom or dad's money on just hitting a button to get more berries for their pony or something.
Wow. Okay. All right. That's something. On the related story, entire side window of the Apple store on Fifth Avenue shattered today. Apparently, it was a snowblower mishap. And they say it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix that. And the store remains open, albeit rather freezing.
Yeah, the number I saw was $450,000 to fix it.
$500,000 to fix a window.
Yeah, apparently it's a very big window, and I think being Apple, it uses proprietary architecture that they can't get just any provider to fill in for them or something.
I think it's just funny that it's Windows that they're dealing with.
And presumably it's not native Google Glass.
Oh, wow. Anyone else? Okay, I think
I was just going to point out that the $32 million to get back slightly to the previous story is just not a lot of money to Apple.
No, definitely not.
Only reinforces it to learn they can spend $500,000 on a window.
Well, they can buy 64 windows now with what they settled that for. So wow. Go ahead, Bernie.
I was going to say it's just probably just a few minutes of Apple's profits that went to pay off the government for their misdeeds without having to admit any wrongdoing. Kind of like what happened to you last week when the government didn't admit to any wrongdoing. How do they get away with not admitting wrongdoing and just paying money?
Yeah, that's definitely true. Speaking of Windows, though, did you know that a lot of ATMs run Windows XP? I didn't know this. And did you know that on April 8th, Microsoft is going to stop offering tech support for Windows XP? I didn't know that either. And that means that ATMs that are running Windows XP are no longer going to receive regular security patches and will not be in compliance with industry standards. Most machines that get upgraded will shift to Windows 7, which has been around since 2009. I wonder what this is going to mean for those banks that don't upgrade their machines in time. Is there going to be some kind of security scandal?
Are these ATMs on the internet? Because that sounds like the much bigger scandal, if true.
Everything is on the internet these days, Mike. Everything.
Right.
And that is a scandal. You're right. But... Well, April 8th, let's mark that day. Maybe there'll be some fireworks. And Starbucks is in the news. They have apparently been storing mobile passwords in clear text. That's right. Usernames, email addresses, passwords have been stored in clear text for their mobile payment app here in the United States. The credentials were stored in such a way that anyone with access to the phone can see the passwords and usernames by connecting the phone to a PC. No jailbreaking of the phone is necessary. And that clear text also displays an extensive list of geolocation tracking points, latitude, longitude, that kind of thing, which is a treasure trove of security and privacy gems for anyone who steals the phone. Wow. They've been kind of caught. They could have chosen not to store the password on the phone, but then users would be forced to key in their username and password every time they wanted to use the app to make a purchase.
Wait, that is not true. There's many alternative architectures they could have used.
Why don't you tell them? Maybe this can be cleared up very easily then.
Okay, I'm sure they can afford my rates. No problem.
Maybe they can. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe everyone's demanding money, and they just wanted to, you know, provide convenience. But, yeah, so clear text. Wow, that's something. Hey, we should take phone calls. What's our phone number? 212. Sorry. 212-209-2900 is our telephone number. We'd like to hear from you if you have any thoughts on news of the day or of the week or of the month. Anything involving the NSA or Edward Snowden or hackers in general, questions maybe about the Hope Conference, incidents involving your life and the challenge of technology, telephones, computers. What else could we be talking about? All sorts of things, right? All you have to do is call 212-209-2900. Go ahead, Bernie.
Surveillance. If you feel like you're under surveillance, call us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Surveillance. The only thing is that, Bernie, it's possible you might not hear them. It's possible they might hear you. So,
I'm used to it.
We're going to have to be we'll tiptoe around it. We'll see if we can do this gracefully. All right. I'm going to take the first phone call now. If you hear a period of silence, that means that you can't hear them. Good evening. You are on Off the Hook.
Hi. I would like to talk to the host, please. I have a question regarding,
Before you go any further, let me just say that you are on the radio right now. So if you can think of that question, this would be a great time to do it.
Oh, sure. I want to expose a case that has just happened with AT&T and the way they do their contract and how they're basically tying me up to their contract.
Okay. Let me first step in here and ask Bernie, are you able to hear any of that?
Yeah, I heard them fine.
Okay, great. Okay, so what specifically is your question? Or observation?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Did you have a specific question or observation?
Well, yes. Basically, I know we don't have much time. I wanted to know if within the U.S. there is an actual service, a cell phone service that I can use without being tied up to a contract. I know that there's a way of doing that by you buying a phone that is off contract. So... what would you suggest? What would be companies that you suggest?
Well, I do know T-Mobile doesn't have contracts for many of their services. I also know that it's possible to do prepay and not have a contract in that particular case. So the options are out there.
I have tried the prepay, but unfortunately, their service is not very good.
Well, what do you require with service?
I had an iPhone 4S. And I need it a lot, or I use it a lot for emailing. So I need a good bandwidth coming and outgoing for that, and a lot of texting as well.
Okay.
What company was the iPhone 4S originally connected with?
AT&T.
Okay, so it's a GSM iPhone. So you can only use it on either T-Mobile or AT&T wireless. You could not use it with Verizon or with Sprint because they use CDMA as opposed to DSM. So your options are limited right there. As Emmanuel mentioned, T-Mobile has a prepaid service. They have no contract service, and that's probably your best option, frankly.
T-Mobile.
Well, it's not hard because there's only, as Bernie says, two companies that you could use that do GSM in this country. If one doesn't work, then use the other.
Has anyone ever tried it? If you make a conference call to the representatives of the two companies and try and get them to like bid against each other for your service?
It's hard enough getting one representative on the phone and not having a computer to deal with. But thanks for that call. We're going to move on. And good evening. You are on Off the Hook.
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a quick question about AT&T.
Go ahead. It sounds very much like the last call, but go ahead.
Yes. I wanted to know, how is it possible for me to, separate from a phone plan, like a family phone plan?
Like not have a contract?
No, you know how they have, family plans all together?
Oh, so you want to basically split up from your family and just sort of venture out on your own?
Yeah.
Ah, can you do that? I've never been part of another service, Rob.
It's an important time in every kid's life when this happens. But, if you have your own phone number on your family's plan, you should be able to start up service somewhere else and then port your phone number over to it so you could keep the same number and move it over to whatever future service you got.
But they'd have to terminate whatever it is they're on right now. Are you looking to do this without letting the rest of the family know?
I mean, I don't want to be sneaky. I mean, I'm kind of thinking about it.
Uh-huh.
It's an option, but...
Well, you know what? Call the representative for your company and just ask them how that works. Have you tried that yet?
No, not quite.
Yeah.
Just have one manual. More question, not to bother you guys.
Okay, one more question from you, and then we're going to hear from Bernie.
Okay. For in terms of the iPhone and, like, computers term-wise, so I've recently been using Windows 8.
My condolences. So
yes. I'm actually a Windows XP fan. Unfortunately, I heard your broadcast.
I like XP, too. It does everything I need it to do for the machine I use it on, and I resent being pushed into getting things that, to be honest, are more of a pain to use, but that's just me.
Yeah. But the main thing that I hate about Windows XP is that every time I sync my iPod, it constantly wants to go into iTunes and then back it up, and then when I try to see the backup, it won't allow me to do anything. So if I try to go into iCloud and see that backup, it won't let me view that backup. Any suggestions?
You know, I'm sure there's an answer to this, and probably the personal computer people coming on after us would be better suited to answer that question. So I suggest
manual.
Calling them, and they might not. Now, Bernie, yes, what do you have?
I just wanted to warn our caller that he may not be able to get that mobile carrier, AT&T Wireless, to change anything if he is not the authorized contact for the account, which might be one of his parents.
Well, that but at least that fact can be conveyed, just to get the information as to what would be required.
Right.
Then he can go and impersonate his parents later. I didn't.
Online too.
No, that's not good advice. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to actually.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. I'm not an idiot completely to do that. So,
yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck with that. Let us know how it turns out. I'm always willing to help out the young people out there. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
All right.
Please turn down your radio.
It's down.
All right.
There it goes.
All right. What's on your mind?
All right. The story about the guy in the movie theater in Ohio with those Google glasses.
Google glasses, yes.
That is so weird.
Isn't it?
It's really out there.
It's out there.
I mean, I'm just wondering, what's to stop them from checking? When they're going to start checking people when they go into the theater for cell phones with cameras on them? I mean, heaven forbid somebody would want to... maybe they want to tape the movie. It's really good. Or maybe they want to check a scene or tape the scene in the movie. What's to stop them?
Yeah, well...
There's already technology for this. The MPAA has announced, although I think it's mostly a smoke and mirrors, that they have technology that was borrowed from a military contractor to seek out lenses. They have, like, special cameras and sensors back behind the movie screen, up above the movie screen, and they look to see if there are like, camcorder lenses or the lenses on cell phone cameras, and they can detect them and point them, put them all on a screen so the security people know exactly what seat to go to grab the person taking the video of the movie.
That's kind of scary. I didn't know they had that technology. Wow.
Ironically enough, Bernie, if you were to actually build such a system, probably mirrors and or smoke would actually be involved.
Yeah, in this particular case.
You guys are kidding.
We're not kidding. I wish we were. But thanks for that call. We have time for one more. Let's see who's out there. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello.
Yes, speak up.
Hi. I was curious. I had a question about the Hope Conference. I didn't know if there would be an applicable room rate at the Pennsylvania Hotel.
Oh, excellent question. Yes, in fact, there is. We just announced it this week, and we totally forgot to mention it on the radio. There is a special rate. You call the Hotel Pennsylvania, ask for the Hope X rate, or you go to the link that we provide on our website. And believe it or not, this is kind of amazing. The rate is actually lower than it was 2 years ago. So that's pretty awesome.
And Emmanuel, what's the phone number for the Hotel Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania 65000. Now, the way you spell that, obviously, is PE 736 5000, area code 212. Oldest phone number in the world. thanks for that question. All right, take care. And that's going to pretty much do it for us here tonight on Off the Hook. We'll be back again next week. You can write to us, OTH@2600.com. We'll be happy to hear from you. Maybe we'll even read your letter on the radio. Meanwhile, stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show here on WBAI. Stay out of trouble. Stay out of controversy, because Lord knows hackers don't want you to get involved in that kind of a thing. It's Emmanuel for Off the Hook. See you next week. Good night.
Hey, man, that was off the hook. That's what I say. Oh, my goodness. Hey, they come out with great music out there. Hey, you know, everything's going on. Is it cold enough for you?
No,
it's not cold enough for you. It's cold enough for me. I'll tell you that in New York City. And, you know, we got the personal computer show coming up. But before that, I want to say, stay warm, everybody. Lots of hot cocoa and hot chocolate and coffee and what have you. Any other kind of things that you may do to get you going. All right. That being said, how about this? All right, this is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, also streaming on the web at WBAI.org. You can listen to the streaming web at PCRadioShow.org. And today is January 22nd, 2014, and this is the Personal Computer Show. Right, Hank and Joe?
Yes, it is. Yes, indeed. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is Hank Key, and I'm in the studio with Stevie DB. And we have on remote Joe King. And Stevie, did you hook him up yet?
He's hooked.
Yeah. I'm here, and I have one question. Actually, I have two or three questions for you, but I have one question for you. Has Stevie still got that asthma?
No. Yeah, well, in a way, he does. And by the way, did you see Stevie on TV today? He was out in Central Park playing the djembe.
Yeah. You saw that?
I did not see that, and I didn't know you could play a frozen djembe.
Yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. It couldn't have been Stevie because it was a very handsome fella. Well, tonight we have some news to go over, and we have a topic of discussion, and somewhere around about the 15 minutes after the hour, we're going to talk about a subject matter that may be of interest to everyone. Joe, you want to tell us what that's going to be?
You know, Hank, this is a question that we have been asked numerous times over the years, and every time I mention a certain kind of a bargain, somebody says, well, is it really a bargain? Hank, I'm going to ask you tonight to explain to us, what's the difference between a 16-gigabyte US flash drive that I bought for $16 and a 16-gig USB flash drive that Stevie bought for half that price?
It's an $8 difference.
Well, we're going to talk about that, okay? But before we do, let's talk about something that is really very near-term and very immediate. And as we had reported on, Windows XP support from Microsoft ends April the 8th of this year.
Oh, no.
So we're only talking about maybe 60-plus days, away from that. However, many of the anti-malware publishers like Norton and Symantec and so on, they said that they will continue to provide the necessary data mapping as new malware comes up, and it's going to be for some indefinite period of time. So Microsoft has made an announcement that they will continue providing anti-malware signatures for security essentials until through July 14th of next year. So XP, in a sense, will probably continue to live. Hey, Joe, you know, the XP population is now down to about 27% of the installed base, and it's falling rapidly. And
how do they figure that out, Hank?
Oh, from what it is that you have a couple of companies tracking browser usage, and they can determine from the browser what operating system you're using.
I wonder how they do that.
Well,
I'm using the same browser, which is the Google Chrome browser,
mm-hmm.
on XP, and I'm using it on 7,
mm-hmm.
and I'm using it on Android, and I'm using it, you know, every place I've got a browser going. So how do they know what my operating system is?
I don't know, but maybe something that I can do some, investigating into. But as you know, there have been many, many machines sold in the last 35 years. The question is, how many are still considered the installed base? Because many of them, like, I know that I probably threw away more machines than more than half of what I bought already. So This is based on the installed base. And,
okay, but I have right now operating, not how many have I installed over the years, but I've got a netbook, which is running on XP.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a shuttle, which is a desktop running on XP.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got an IBM all-in-one, I think it was called the X41.
Let me put it this way. They are able to track the operating system it runs on.
No, but what I'm saying, Hank, is I've got 5 or 6 working computers. Four or five of them are XP. Now, they're going to abandon me, but I'm not going to upgrade them because they're not worth upgrading.
But the thing is, at some point in time, you're going to stop using it, too, because of security. Think about that. At some point in time, you're going to say, I think I'm going to start using Windows 7 or 8
If they're going to force me to abandon a perfectly good working machine, then I'm going to go to an Android machine, not to another.
Fine. Or you may just say, I'm going to upgrade this machine to 7, 8, or...
Or whatever else.
Or Linux, or anything else.
I'll go to Linux or I'll go to Android, but if Microsoft is going to force me if they're going to force me into abandoning working hardware, then I'm not going to let them force me. I'll abandon it, but I will not let them force me into buying something else from them.
Joe,
I don't believe you, Joe.
Joe, let me put it this way: XP was introduced in the year 2001. Okay.
First time out, yes.
Okay, now, when you bought a car in 2001 and the manufacturer says, you know, after 10 years, we're not going to continue with the spare parts, are you going to say, boy, you're screwing me?
Yes.
Okay, guess what? That's the real world we live in.
No, it isn't. I still have a 1993 car that's in
order. That's right. That's right. And you know what you told me? That is sitting in the garage doing nothing.
That's right.
Therefore, it's not considered in use.
I don't need it, but it's in use, and I'm paying for it.
Yeah. By the way, Joe, I make a bet you can't even start up that car in today's weather.
No, I probably can't because I haven't started.
You have a dead battery, right?
Yeah. It died at the beginning of the winter.
Well,
right now I'm not prepared to spend $110 to get a new battery for it, but I'll put a trickle charge on it as soon as the weather warms up.
Well,
that's not the point. The point being that my computer, the various computers I have that are running XP, they're not running a 2001 operating system because they're running SP3.
They call that Windows XP.
I don't care what they call it. It's a new operating system from a few years ago. It works perfectly well. It's not green to throw out a working machine that does its job.
Well, you know what? You can continue to use it at your own risk if there's no longer patches being made available.
No, what they're saying to me is that the Microsoft product is no longer good, and I should go find another product, but I shouldn't necessarily throw away the
hardware. Joe, that's your interpretation. What they're saying is that April 8th, they're stopping all patch support other than providing the anti-malware signatures for security essentials.
Isn't there a procedure, Hank, for running Android on a Wintel machine?
Yes, you can download a copy of Chrome OS to run on Intel machines.
And isn't there also a way of running Linux on an Intel machine?
In fact, you can run the... first of all, there's at least 1,500 versions of Linux. So, in terms of a full blown one, you probably need some newer machines. But in terms of something like damn small Linux, you know, you could take something going back to 1995, 93, 1990, and still be able to run it.
And aren't there, if I forget Linux or Chrome, aren't there antivirus programs available for me?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. In other words, you are treating it as antivirus in terms of patches, but sometimes they have security holes in some of the components that has nothing to do with antivirus.
All right, I agree with that. Now, how security on Linux boxes? Is that as good as the Windows security?
If you want good security on Linux boxes, you select the Linux versions which are in regular updates. There are many versions of Linux which are like they're 5 years old. They haven't been updated. Some even go back further than that. I would avoid that.
How do I determine a current one to use?
If you go to distrowatch.com and you bring up whatever a version that you want, it tells you when it was last updated.
So there's a way I can do all of this. If I simply want to avoid spending a few $100s.
Right. And Joe, don't complain to me that you can't run TurboTax on the Linux, okay?
No, I don't use TurboTax, Hank.
Yeah, I know. You take it to your your accountant.
I do the same thing with my taxes that I do with my computers. I take them to an expert to be fixed.
Oh, okay. So you're the 1% that has the accountant do your taxes, where poor little people like Stevie and I, you know, we have to rely on.
I go to an accountant.
Oh, Stevie's part of that 1% now. Yeah. You see, yeah,
the 99%.
Incidentally, that 1% turns out to be about 99%. But if you want to follow up on it, Hank, you follow up on the bad taxes. I'll follow up on the bad operating.
Okay. Now, I just also want to announce that HP is now. They always had Windows 7 available, but you had to go out of your way to say, I want to buy an HP machine, and they'll say you want 8 or 8.1, and then you have to find which models may have Windows 7. They're now saying, you want Windows 7? You got it, and they tell you up front, right there, you want it, you have it, you don't even have to go find it, it's there. So
Windows 7
is stable.
It is stable, it works on most modern machines. Probably works on all modern machines.
I have news for you. I got Windows 7 running on a 2002 machine.
So what's... Okay. Of course.
So it's not even necessary to have a very modern machine. The problem is that Windows 8 and 8.1 were not really well thought out. I understand what they were trying to do. And there is a niche market for the touchscreen desktop, but it's a niche market.
Nah, by the way.
Don't use a touchscreen for the...
Nah. You know what?
You're saying that, but I'm sitting right now at a computer desk with a Lenovo computer in it, and I can't touch the screen from where I'm sitting. My arm is not long enough to touch the screen.
If you have